Blog Talk Radio.
Fasten your seatbelts. The foremost authority on 9/11, the best-selling author of Methodical Illusion, and a researcher extraordinaire, Rebecca Roth is about to step up to the microphone and launch into Reality Check, where the light will shine brightly upon the truth.
And now, live from the downtown Metroplex Library of Ajo, Arizona, former home to Phelps Dodge Copper Mine and once the tallest smokestack of any smelting factory in the United States, it's the Rebecca Roth Show.
You know, I think we ought to do a second show pretty soon after I get this book out, and let's call it the Ramjet Conspiracy Hour, just for those internet conspiracy nuts that are dying to know, what size underwear do you wear? How do you like your coffee? And everything else about you. They're trying to figure out who you are. I just,
you know,
love it.
You can joke about that all you want, but do you know what ajo means?
No,
in
tell
Spanish?
Me. No.
Garlic.
Oh.
So we're from Garlic, Arizona.
All right. Well, is it hot there?
You know, Ajo is an interesting place. It used to be a pretty good-sized copper town. Copper dried up. Now it's basically a illegal alien hangout and border patrol.
Oh, and garlic.
No garlic.
Oh, they don't grow garlic?
No garlic.
They name the town after garlic and don't grow it there, huh?
What are you going to do?
I don't know. It's pretty wild. Well, welcome to the Rebecca Roth Show again. I can't believe time goes by so fast. And we hope that everything's coming in loud and clear. I know we've had to pre-record a couple shows, and only because I have been I needed to get in my feet on the ground doing some research. And I think you'll really recognize that when you read this third book, because I, as I'm writing it, I'm so glad I actually went and walked walked the walk so I could talk the talk and type the talk. And so we did, and I know that when we upload these things onto YouTube, they have a volume issue going on. So I'm hoping that this turns out better for you, and hopefully it turns out better for us. When I upload them onto YouTube, it seems to have volume. So I don't know. I know that Blog Talk's been working a lot of on the upgrades and stuff. So let's just hope they get it done, because there's always going to be times where you have to either do a rebroadcast or pre-record a show, and so we did that, and I got lots of good comments on that last show. We talked about, you know, the predictive programming and what we see in the news, and preparation, getting prepared for just about anything, and that kind of leads me into what we're going to talk about today, too, because I think we're being set up again through all the news and the TSA, so we're going to talk about that. But just, I know a lot of people have, I've been inundated with fabulous emails. I can't believe it. It's always a pleasure, I have to say, to get the kind of email. And every time I get these, I should print this out so I could read it on the show. Without, of course, giving anyone's name or personal information out. But, you know, it is so awesome. I have a school teacher that has a couple dozen methodical illusion in New York.
He had a couple of dozen.
and they're probably dwindling pretty quickly. And he had been sharing with some teachers. And so he was in, I think, his study hall and talking to one of the teachers that had read Methodical Illusion. And she is now a new person when it comes to looking at 9/11. Now, in New York, I mean, this is in their backyard. So not in the city, but upstate just a little bit. But you don't have to go, you know, very far. And in Manhattan, New York just affects you if you're in the state.
Well, didn't you tell me that he was having a conversation with one of these
teachers? Yeah. And one of the kids overheard and went home, I guess, and said something to the parent. Called, he said, I thought I was going to get in trouble from this parent. And the parent said, my son told me you were talking about, I want that author's name and the name of those books, because he had, I believe, been in New York working. and knew that it was not what they showed us on TV. So I don't know if he got an autograph book. I don't know if he got it through Amazon or if he was given a book from my teacher friend that has a couple dozen books from the first edition Methodical Illusion to share. So I'm really excited to hear it because it's so cool when I find out. And he was like, God, it was so great because this parent said, I just got to read her books. Yeah.
You know, there are still some of those books available.
Oh, yeah.
Not many, but yeah.
I've got a box that I've got. Just found a note that I left before I went researching for on my old one of my old computers when I opened it up to a gal that's going to put in some libraries. So if you have a local library and you can ask them if they'll take a brand new book donated, and I'll autograph it for you too if they want. And we will send you those just free. I mean, we're cool. If you want to pay the postage, you can go into either my websites. There's a PayPal thing there for any donations.
And the postage is not that expensive. It's like $15 for 24 books.
Yeah. And there's several of those. These are the first edition, so you're going to find a little couple of mistakes here and there. And the foreword is not the same as the latest edition, but that's okay. It's still a good story, and it still wakes people up, and that's the name of the game, I'm telling you, is waking people up. And I know it's really amazing that I'm also getting emails from people that were in New York and saw things, and unfortunately, I'm having to dig a little bit and research some things, and which is cool because I want to put it in this hopefully last book. I don't know. I keep thinking that. I mean, I thought the first book was the one and only, but information just keeps coming. So, but I'll try to get everything I can up to date. And before everything gets put together with the formatter at the printers through the publishing process, I'm adding stuff. I mean, right in both books, I've just added stuff till practically the night before it's all done. So, I really appreciate it, though, and I love to hear people that have woken up family and friends. It's just such a – it was so worth it just to hear a compliment now and then that thank you for waking up my family. I shared your books.
You mean you wake up out of your sleep saying, hold the presses.
I kind of do. And when I think about that second book when near the end of – the process, I got a call from someone who had actually seen United 175 landing. So I'm like, I have to work this in. And when you're writing a novel, it's kind of fun because you have your characters and you have, you know, they can sit and meet, have a cup of coffee, get a phone call, text message, whatever, email, and so you can deliver all of the information to the reader. So that's the challenging part is when you go through and you find out all this stuff is to put it in a story that it's a page turner and an eye opener at the same time. So it's really fun. I never thought I would be an author, but I guess that's the road I'm on right now. And I just really love getting email from people that, you know, I've had just a great experience waking up friends or family, so many people didn't believe what they showed us on TV. And, you know, it's really interesting. After you wake up and you realize that the hijackers weren't killed, so how did that happen? That's what happened to me. And I think the paradigm shift that everyone has to make, and I know personally when I was doing the initial research, I had been so brainwashed by the media that I had to keep going back to going, but I have 10 of these hijackers still alive, and I have people in government intelligence saying the other 9 were probably complete makeup, make believe. They were fake completely. And I'm like, okay, well, so then what really did happen? And I kept reverting back to that because I'd been brainwashed to think that 19 Arabs did this, just like everyone else. And that is the paradigm shift that is, you have to make that shift. Not only were we brainwashed to think that 19 Arabs did this and could fly the aircraft beyond the aircraft's capability, and these guys didn't even know how to fly a Cessna or had flunked out of training for flight school in a small aircraft like a Cessna. So they're not going to get in a jumbo jet and fly it beyond its capability. And, you know, all of this information is available to look and go to Boeing's site, and they've got charts to tell you how fast a 767 and a 757 can fly at 35,000 feet, they cannot fly that fast at sea level or 1,000 feet or 700 feet to go into those buildings like they were. They can't. It's just impossible. So they can't go 700 miles an hour, but we do know that a missile can. And so when a missile goes by you 700 miles an hour, you can probably find YouTubes of these. It's real hard to see them. And I keep getting information from people that were in New York. They were on the ferry boat. There was no traffic. There was no airplanes. They didn't see any plane. All they saw was an explosion. And now, if you've ever been to Manhattan, you know that you have very little vision of sky. If you look up, there's so many tall buildings that your vision of a sky might be just the width of the street and the sidewalks. And that's all you can see. That's blue sky up there. And that's, you know, coming out of the West Coast for me, when I first was laying over in Manhattan, I couldn't believe people that live there and never get out. I'm like, they've never seen the sky, like Montana, you know, big skies. And even California, I mean, you just don't see that many high-rise, tall skyscraper buildings that take up your sky when you're standing down below. You know, 100 stories or 50 stories above you. You just get very little vision, and you just hear from people. I hear from people all the time. They were in the building next door. They were looking out the window. All they saw was an explosion. They never heard an airplane, never saw an airplane. One guy told me that he heard what sounded like a garbage truck hit a big pothole. We've probably all heard that on garbage day. What he said he heard was not an aircraft. And so, I mean, he's walking, talking, believing that there was no airplanes at all. So anyway, that kind of leads us to, well, what was it? But it leads us to what we're going to talk about today, which is the TSA and security. And we're going to keep that in mind. What we talked about in the last couple of weeks ago is that predictive programming. And what you're being programmed to do right now is to be aware, because they're telling you on the media that TSA has, this is Saul Alinsky, you'll remember this, overwhelm the system. Now, TSA has 55,600 employees, 55,600 employees. Now, that's how many employees were in the major airline I worked for at one point. And their budget is about $8 billion with a B. And they have never caught yet a terrorist or stopped a hijacker from getting on board in 15 years. So let's talk about what's up now, because, you know, TSA came through the Department of Homeland Security right after 9/11. This is one of the first things they did.
It was actually sanctioned in December. So, you know, in less than 4 months, mm-hmm. they put all the legislation together to be able to create and form TSA, which in and of itself is a miraculous thing. It's probably the most miraculous thing TSA has ever done.
Yeah, really. Well, through the Department of Homeland Security, which was created after 9/11. And the interesting thing I remember is the president and the administration, the Bush administration, blaming the agencies. The FBI didn't share information with the CIA, and the CIA didn't share information with the blah, 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 Interpol didn't, you know, we're not sharing information. It's too spread out. And so do they do. They form the Department of Homeland Security and created a huge monster. And of that, they were then in control of the TSA. They had a transition period for about 6 months, maybe, before they put all these people in, and they hired and people off the street, I don't know, shoe salesmen, who knows? I don't know what they were, but they were kids, kind of. I mean, for me, I was, you know, older, so they looked like kids.
Well, you know, prior to TSA, they were run primarily by private companies.
Yeah, Huntley USA ran most of the airports.
Many of them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even today with the TSA, any airport can opt out of having TSA agents there. And there are very few of them that have done that. Most of them are really small, like Jackson Hole, Wyoming Airport. I don't know if you've ever flown in there or not, but, you know, it's just a very small regional airport. San Francisco International is the only big airport that has private security. And I'm curious to know, it's been a long time since I've flown into San Francisco. you know, if I'm going to go in that direction, I usually, you know, fly into Oakland or into San Jose just because it's, you know, more convenient.
Right.
But I'm wondering if things run a little more smoothly in a large airport like that.
Mm, that's interesting.
Based on their private. Now, if they're private, but they have to follow the TSA guidelines. So they have to, you know, wear the uniforms and they have to wear and do whatever, you know, the TSA basically tells them to do. But
do they wear a TSA uniform?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yep. And so even then, you know, just the fact that they're private, I wonder if they're more efficient and are able to avoid a lot of the confusion that TSA generates.
Thing. You know, I found this when I was a flight attendant. Every year, Christmas snuck up on the corporation I worked for. Every year, everyone wanted to be home with their family on December 24th and 25th. Amazing. And every year there was a shortage of flight attendants and pilots over the Christmas, New Year's holiday. Why? Because everybody wanted to be home. And it was the end of the year, and people had, you know, vacation time or they had sick time or stuff to they could use. And so we were always shorthanded. Well, every year that I flew, 31 plus, we had summer. And summer meant summer vacation. And for 15 years that TSA has been pushing around, every year comes summer travel. Now, they've known about this since January that this was going to be a problem. Now, I'm not quite sure exactly why they're having a problem because they obviously hire people that aren't the best quality. So it's not like it's a quality control standard for their hiring. I don't know if people are just walking out or they don't pay very well. So I don't know if people, I know a lot of them have been
busted. You know, actually that's not true. Their starting salary is somewhere between $25,000 and $38,000, depending on upon where you're at. And, you know, if you, and you know, it doesn't require any education. You don't have a college degree or anything like that. That's not a horrible salary for somebody that's, you know, starting into the workforce and then has various bonuses that come into play depending on where they are. For example, if they're in Alaska or Hawaii or some of the places where it's harder to get people, you know, they can get as much as a 35% bonus. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the problems that the TSA has faced is, you know, their, you know, budget overruns that they continually have, and all of it's, you know, generally involved with their employment practices. You know, they're just abominable.
Well, I guess, you know, we're in trouble now with the TSA because you can't get rid of them. But yeah, you really can do something to get rid of them. But one of the things I'm seeing now is they are talking about 2 and 3 hour waits. Now, there's a few videos going around. I know Alex Jones, InfoWars, had one just a couple days ago. I would have played it, but the language for this guy, I mean, he was so overwhelmed that he kind of kept cussing. So, but you can go find it on InfoWars, the TSA, if you just probably Google search a TSA wait lines. He was in Chicago's Midway, so that might help you too, airport, which wasn't a heavily used airport when I was flying. But the security line was 2+ hours long, and it went all the way back to the parking garage, all the way through. I mean, it just snakes through. And so you're seeing places like Denver where they've got all of that front end of the new DIA, the whole front end. You go in, and everyone that gets into that airport goes through security right there in this, you know, giant thing. Well, it's just jam-packed all the way out through the front doors, all the way out to the sidewalks, right? And that's what's going on everywhere. I don't know, maybe not San Francisco, but we don't know because we're not there. But they do have private security, which is good to know. If you are standing in line, here's the trouble. And you have, let's say you got to go potty, or you're diabetic and you're starting to lose your blood sugar and you've got to go get something to eat, grab yourself some orange juice or something, and you're standing in line for 2 hours and you get out of line, you're all of a sudden looked at as a guilty party, a possible terrorist because you're getting out of that line. And they can come right after you if you get out of that line. So
can and will.
Yes, they do. So you see, we've got some issues with that. And we've got lots of people. I mean, just look at elderly people that can't stand that long. I mean, they're, you know, you're just, you know, you're just have a bad hip or bad knee or whatever.
Well, what's worse, if you get out of line, let's say you stood in line for an hour and you've got to go to the bathroom, and so you get out of line, you're in the back of the line.
You got another hour to wait on top of there. It's just crazy. So you can see what can happen. So your 2-hour wait could become a 4-hour wait if you have to go to the bathroom or something.
Well, one of the things that TSA also did, as they began to evolve through their, 10-15 year existence, is they started hiring behavioral analysis personnel that, walk up and down the line and they check for behavioral issues. And they claim that, they're not profiling, because that was always the big concern with regards to that. And so they claim that, oh, we're just looking at behavioral aspects.
Yeah, so if you're doing a pee-pee dance because your bladder's ready to burst.
Well, exactly. I mean, if I'm in a 5-minute line, I'm going to behave a lot differently than if I'm in a 2-hour line.
Exactly. Or a 3-hour line. Some places are. I know recently one of our adult children has traveled and got a phone call from two phone calls or a phone call and a text message, I guess, or email from the airline that said, prepare for a 2+ hour wait. Now, she got lucky because she got right through, but it was a kind of a miracle. I don't know how it happened, but they are, if you are flying, they are, because it started in January. This really this big holdup, and really summer isn't until June when all the kids get out of school. Mid-June starts the summer travel. You don't even see that much heavy travel like we do over Thanksgiving. Over Memorial Weekend, it's not even that heavy, which is coming up. But since it is coming up, and a lot of people have an extra day off, so they go someplace for the longer weekend, you're probably going to hear of 3- and 4-hour waits at TSA. Well, here's what's happening. Since they're overwhelming the system, they are not catching the prohibited items. And so a lot of, they're telling us this on the media, that's why I'm telling you, the setup, the predictive programming is the system is so overwhelmed. We're so overworked. There's too many people. There's 3- and 4-hour waits. There's thousands of people trying to get through. People are crabby. People are hungry. People are, having to wet their pants and in line and just, madder than you know what. And so there's all kinds of stress. And the TSA workers are missing. Now, just so you know, even before TSA, airline employees, we could go through. A lot of it was done by the ticket agents and people that work inside the terminal. Could have been maybe somebody that was just working at a, Burger King, or somebody that was a ticket agent, somebody. They would be tagged by the FAA to carry through security a prohibited item. And it could have been a gun without, a gun. It could have been a knife. It could have been something that was built like a pipe bomb, but not an explosive, just a fake. And they did that to test them. And, they failed a lot. And this was Huntley USA, obviously, the ones that failed through 9/11. But the private-owned securities would miss that a lot. And I had a gal friend that was a ticket agent, and she ended up, being asked to go through all the time with different things and testing different security agents.
But they're still doing that with the TSA.
They do still do that.
And they're worse. They're worse.
They have a 95% failure rate. They're telling us this. So I'm telling you this because you're being told that they have a 95% failure rate, which means they can bring in all of those items that are prohibited. Box cutters, bombs, guns, 9/11 stuff that was all prohibited then. And it all supposedly got through. But it didn't really. But
well, I think I know why.
It was because those invisible hijackers. Anyway, it's amazing to see when you look at how the media is programming you. And if you get to the point where you realize, maybe through reading Methodical Illusion, that this isn't what happened. We were hoodwinked, as the Max Hager, my character, says. We were fooled. We were hoodwinked. We've been lied to, and we've been lied to, and our kids have been lied to, and our soldiers have been lied to. Now, a lot of them come home, lots of guilt from killing innocent people, and they realize that all of this is over heroin. And oil. So it's the heroin they see on the streets. I know that we've gone through some towns of 1,200 and 1,500 people and, you know, maybe sitting at a cafeteria found out that the biggest problem in town is heroin. And it just blows my mind to think that in these tiny little towns across America out in the middle of nowhere, their biggest problem is heroin. Well, where do you think that heroin comes from? Afghanistan. So you got people coming home that have been killing people, and they're dealing with their guilt, and they're having what we call post-traumatic stress now because of the position they were put in, and they were hoodwinked too. They were told it was 19 Arabs. Now, so we've been going on for 15, 16 years now, being taught by and brainwashed to hate a group of people that had nothing to do with 9/11. Now, just going to quickly touch on the 28 pages. Because people keep asking me that. I got a few emails this last week from people, maybe they don't listen to the show or they've never heard me say this, but I'll tell you what I told them. It is my understanding from everything that I have read and as deep as I've gone down this rabbit hole, that the 28 pages that they withheld from the public, from the 9/11 Commission hearings, in the footnotes, the 28 pages indicate the involvement of the Israeli intelligence agency, the Mossad. So they are not going to be made public until they either rewrite them or we have a multiple city false flag going and we've got survival on our minds instead of the truth about 9/11.
But I think also in those 28 pages, they talk about the connection that Saudi Arabia had with the so-called quote-unquote terrorists as they evolved throughout the United States. And many of the stories that are associated with them, the pink-haired strippers and the gambling and the drinking and all of those, you know, where they followed them around. Yeah, they may have done that, and they may have had some kind of Saudi involvement. The point is they weren't involved with the hijackings.
That's right.
So all of that stuff is moot. And, you know, they wash that out and don't release
it. One of the things that was important to do, and I know that looking back, if you look into the John F. Kennedy assassination, and if you go out and listen to Chuck O'Chelly's show, the Chuck O'Chelly Effect, you can find his YouTube channel is The Blind, what was it? Or Blind Researcher, I think. Chuck O'Chelly. Extremely, really a great researcher into the John F. Kennedy event and the assassination. And now one of the things for me is I started finding similar things in the cover-up. We've got the sealed documents that, you know, were not ever supposed to come out public until we were all dead and gone. So maybe the 28 pages will come out after we're either preoccupied with survival because we're involved with a, you know, a nuclear war, or we're involved with a, you know, more of their fake terrorism. But what you'll see, and I see this sometimes on Facebook, when I do, I just usually unfriend somebody that does this. You know, you see somebody that has been listening to Fox News, they are completely brainwashed to still believe that 19 Arabs did 9/11. And they will completely put this in front of you everywhere you go. I was at a museum not long ago that had nothing to do with 9/11. And there was a huge 9/11 showcase there about, you know, all these pictures of the towers and all, we will not forget. Well, what will you not forget? We don't even know what the heck happened. How can you forget it? You're constantly being brainwashed, and you're constantly being brainwashed to believe this was Muslims who did this. And it absolutely was not. If there was involvement by the Saudis, they were paying the Israeli Mossad to entertain these patsies all around the country because they had to set this up. Looking back at, Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, looking back now, the same type of stories come out. Oh, he'd been in Russia. Well, during that time, you couldn't go to Russia. Remember? I mean, during the 60s, that was the enemy, just like, you know, whoever our enemy is. I guess our enemy now is Assad in Syria, but that was the enemy, and you couldn't go there. You couldn't get a visa, but somehow he did. And so after the Kennedy thing, not before, and just like with the 19 Arabs, with the pink-haired strippers, all of this information came out. Of course, none of it is anything that a Muslim would do. Especially a radical Muslim, because they don't, they're going to follow their faith. And that pink-haired strippers and cocaine and alcohol doesn't work with the Muslim religion. And so, you know, it's interesting. Let me just interrupt myself for a second here. When a few weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we were talking about this, and I said, now, if you don't know any Muslims, go out and find your nearest mosque. Go find somebody in your neighborhood or your town or in your grocery store. And when you see some lady wearing a scarf or a hijab or a burqa or whatever, you know, there's several different coverings that the women can use, and they all have different names to them. You know, go introduce yourself and get to know their family. And get to, you know what? I got an email from people that did it and said, you know, these people are super nice. And, you know, that was so great. I thought, well, I'm so glad I mentioned that because, you know, I traveled. So for me, I got to meet all kinds of people, all kinds of religions. I've been in Middle Eastern countries in various different, you know, under the Wahhabi, under Shia, and various different Muslim sects. So I've seen what life is like, and I have lots of friends now all around the world, in Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan.
You know, several weeks ago, I had a chance to run down a friend of mine that I hadn't seen in, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and, you know, got reacquainted, and he happens to be from Iran. And as we parted, I gave him a big hug and said, you know, you are my favorite Iranian. And he thought that was just the coolest thing. I probably could not have said anything to him that would have made, you know, him feel better about that. I mean, he's an American as I am. I mean, mm-hmm. he's, you know, naturalized citizen. He's been here for a gazillion years, but, you know, it just is an interesting aspect that, you know, they worry that we don't like them for obvious reasons, yeah. Because we've been trained,
watched Fox
yeah,
News.
Because we've been trained not to like them. And yet, you know, those Muslims and Iranians and Pakistanis that are my friends, I have, you know, just absolutely thoroughly enjoyed them. But I want to get back to the TSA for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were talking about, you know, the various implements of destruction that were going through TSA that they didn't catch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me give you an idea of why maybe they didn't. In 2014, a guy by the name of Jason Harrington, who was a former TSA agent in O'Hare, big airport, Chicago, wrote a book. And in this book, he talked about the kinds of things that they would do. And one of the things that they like to do when they got the naked scanners is they like to make fun of people's genitalia, you know, either the length or the, or you know, the size, the you know, whatnot. If they saw an attractive woman coming, for example, they would throw out a code, Hotel Papa. Hotel Papa meant that, you know, we've got somebody on board here. We're going to make sure she gets funneled through the naked screener. And then they'd congregate in the back room to be able to, you know, view what it is that the mm-hmm. stuff had shown. I mean, they wouldn't all go back there at the same time, but they knew, you know, take mm-hmm. take your turn, go through the rotation. And so they were busy doing things like this. So, of course, they're going to miss
the weapons.
Weapons and the key, yeah. you know, ingredients.
There's absolutely no quality control with the TSA. It's amazing. And, you know, I mean, the whole thing is such a sham. There were not 19 Arab hijackers on board the aircraft. Now, there were some handlers. We're pretty sure of that. As a matter of fact, every single day I wake up, I think, I'm going to get that email that says, you know, I met, well, I did actually get an email. I'm going to share this one. I got an email not long ago from someone who was at the Kentucky Derby with someone who was taking photographs. And, I don't remember all the details of this story, but I don't want to give out too much stuff. Anyway, long story short, the photographer was somehow involved with the court system in Kentucky. And this person who emailed me got to talking about Lady Booth. Lady Booth is Ted Olson's new wife. She's the same size as Barbara Olson. I've been told they're exactly the same height, same physique. And Lady Booth claims to have been an attorney in Kentucky. And so this person asked and found out that there is no history of a Lady Booth ever in the state of Kentucky. What does that tell you? She might be as fake as the 9 hijackers that were really just complete makeup, made believe.
Well, I don't know. Maybe we should hotel papa her through a naked screener and compare her to...
Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of people... I never really thought about this when I first started going through and writing Methodical Illusion. And it wasn't until after Methodical Illusion came out and I started, you know, hooking up with some people and emails and stuff that people said they thought they were 100% sure that Lady Booth was, in fact, Barbara Olson. And now the fact that Lady Booth has no history in America and she's supposed to be she's supposed to be an attorney and she's never been an attorney. She's never been born in Kentucky, raised in Kentucky, gone to school or law school. So she has no identity, according to this woman. I thought it was really interesting. So I thought, well, why didn't they use a different story for her? Well, because she doesn't have an accent. She couldn't be Swedish or German because she doesn't have an accent. So she would have had, it'd been really hard to put in a fake accent all the time, right? So I guess they just thought, well, we'll just throw it out, just like everything else. And now that people are waking up, and this is just fascinating to me, and they look at the explosion of the towers, when the South Tower, the first one to explode, it didn't collapse, it blew up. And you can go on YouTube and look at it, and you stare at it over and over and over again, and go find an atomic bomb and look at that and see what happens. I mean, it just looks like a bomb went off. And, you know, a lot of people that were there just said they've heard multiple explosions. So I'm pretty sure that people there did. All the firefighters heard it. You've seen the YouTube video where the New York firefighters are there going boom, 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 boom. And that's what they heard. They were there. And so you see that when you see a demolition, you see there's all kinds of those on YouTube. And there's multiple boom, 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 boom. So as the building is, you know, got this like fireworks going off inside, but they're larger than that. So but it's really amazing what people now are looking back in hindsight. Thankfully, it's always 2020, but we do need to have eyes that see. And that's why I want you to think about this. If you think you need to go somewhere on an airplane, think again, because not only are you going to be in a 2 or 3 or 4 hour lineup that you can't get out, or if you're going to be out, you're going to be a terrorist in their eyes. So you'll really get reamed into. You may consider a train, or you might consider driving, because they are not catching any of the contraband that's coming through. 95% of it gets through. So now they have an excuse when another 9/11 type of event happens, or maybe, you know, pilots get shot, or people get shot, or there's a decompression because a bullet is shot through a window or through the fuselage.
Well, another interesting aspect of the TSA is, you know, they get the criticism, obviously, from the flying public. You know, they don't like the naked scanners. They don't like the long lines. They don't like having to take off their shoes and their belts and whatnot. And so they conduct surveys, but it's mostly propaganda that they post out there. For example, they'll run a survey that says, you know, 82% of the people surveyed say they like the naked scanner. Well, you know, when you interview my 92-year-old mother, who thinks the naked scanner is just the greatest thing in the world, she hasn't flown since 1974. So, I mean, of course, she's going to think it's great. But the people, the flying public who fly on a regular basis now, for example, if you ask my brother who flies all over the world all the time, you know, he's not interested in any of that. He remembers back in the day when you could just walk on an airplane and, you know, find your seat and everything was cool. Now, maybe that's not the answer. But somewhere in between those two things. Another thing you talked about, you know, you said maybe drive.
Mm-hmm.
They also came out with, a propaganda statement about the unintended consequences of these long lines and the people not wanting to go through TSA. It's increased car accidents on the road. Now, there is no...
So are you telling me there are more people driving than who's in those lines?
No. The point is that what they're saying is go ahead and fly, because if you drive, you run the risk of dying. There's no way in the world they can correlate those two things together.
Crazy. More propaganda.
But it's just more propaganda that just blows smoke up your skirt and makes you, you know, fall into their line of thinking and, you know, whatever it is they're trying to predictively program you to.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because I've got this sensitivity and I can kind of feel like something's about to happen. And I get email from a lot of people that have more sensitivity than me. And people that are sensitive to stuff coming down, and yet I'm trying to just help you have eyes to see and ears to hear when you're being programmed. Once we were talking about the predictive program prior to 9/11, predictive programming, now predictive programming to get into those wars and hate Muslim people. There is something that is going to come down, and a lot of people really feel it now that the powers that be are freaking out that Donald Trump is doing what he's doing with so much hate. I mean, that one campaign, they said they spent $65 or $75 million in TV ads to brainwash people against Trump, the Republican Party. He's going to run on their ticket. They're talking about running a third person. Now, the Republican Party is talking about running someone as a third, or Bernie running as a third or whatever. And it's really crazy. So they're freaking out. Now, this is a prime time for them to pull something off again. And a lot of people that are real sensitive are starting to feel. That's why I felt really compelled to talk about preparation. And I hope that everyone that is going to the store, and honest to goodness, if all you can afford is a large bag, and if you can go to a store like a Winco or Costco, or, you know, a big store where you can get a big bag of stuff, bulk stuff, or co-op or something, and get yourself a, you know, a couple large bags of rice and a couple large bags of oatmeal, do it, because for, you know, $35, $45, you can have a whole lot of stuff to put in your tummy, because you want to be as prepared as you can. Even if you don't have a lot of money, you can do this, but do it. Don't wait, because when you wait, if it's all coming down, those people in Manhattan on 9/11, if they didn't bring water with them and took it out of the buildings with them when they were running down the street covered in that dust, whatever was in it. You know, they ran out of stuff everywhere. It was really difficult until they organized in a lot of the local New Jersey and New York first responders, then organized, you know, water brigades to come and bring the responders bottles of water to drink, because there was all that dust everywhere. And so your grocery stores are going to be empty in no time flat. So make sure you have stuff. And be prepared. And when it's happening, understand that you're probably being lied to by the media for a reason. And a lot of people think that something is going to happen this summer or this fall. It'll maybe the September 11th anniversary. Who knows? Something. That'd be a great way to make it look like the Arabs did it or the Muslims did it, if they did it on 9/11, because they would like you to think that they did it, because they're still pushing that stupid story.
Yeah, but they won't, because, you know, people tend to be a little bit more on guard right around that period of time. I mean, they're going to catch you by surprise.
Yeah, well, it
as
could
best
be,
they can.
Could be in August. It could be any time. But if they do something in several cities, like I talked about in the Methodical Illusion, I actually found that plan in a newspaper from the Middle East, and they didn't list the city, so I just made it up for the novel part. But 5 or 6 major cities under attack over a 9-day period, you're looking at martial law. You're not going to go to Walmart and pick your stuff up.
And you're not going to vote for Trump or anybody else.
You're not going to vote, period. You're going to be trying to figure out how in the hell to survive. And so that's what I want people to really be thinking about and get prepared, because I'm not the only one that's feeling this. Because when I get email from people that are telling me what they feel, it's, and these are people that are more of the intuitive, psychic, or, you know, just really spiritual Christians, and they, people can feel it. You got your spidey senses going. If you get to a point in your life where you stop ignoring your spidey senses and you start to think, oh yeah, okay, well, okay, that's it. And, you know, don't just think, oh, I've got all the stuff I need for me, because your neighbors might not. And so, you know, what I do is I have a food saver, and I buy large bags of grains, rice and wheat and things like that, oatmeal, And then I take my food saver bag and I break them up into an, you know, makes an airtight bag of stuff to about a, you know, 7 to 10 pound bag, because that way I can give it to someone who doesn't have anything to survive. And you can share your stuff, because if your neighbors or their kids are starving, it'd be really nice of you to have an extra bag of, you know, 7 pounds of oatmeal, for instance. A 25-pound bag of oatmeal, it runs about $15, and it's 252 servings of oatmeal. And you could even eat that for dinner. It's very nutritious. So it breaks down real slow into your system. So, you see, I know that people think, well, I can't afford to do this. Well, you know, when I first started doing my food storage and getting prepared, I went through and I found all my little piggy banks and places like in my laundry room where I was putting quarters and change, you know, as you collect coins. I took them to a Coinstar, one of these little things in the grocery store. And I had enough coins just in my, you know, old purses and coat pockets and stuff to buy almost $100 worth of stuff in bulk. And so that's what I did. And that's how I first started. And I thought, well, what if we don't have 25 years? I don't need 25-year freeze-dried storage. I just need something to have now. So that's what I recommend. It's really inexpensive. For $45, you can get yourself set up pretty darn good. Don't forget to save all your containers for water and fill them, because you're going to need water to flush your toilet, to wash your hands, and to drink. There's all kinds of water you're going to need. So if you just store your water out in the garage, it's okay. Don't drink that water, but it's okay to use to flush your toilet or to wash your hands and that sort of thing. So I would just recommend that people get prepared. And when it all starts coming down, don't be surprised, because that's what they want you to be, scared. Because remember how scared we were on 9/11? They could easily program our little brains. I was brainwashed just like everyone else. I just couldn't believe it. 19... kids, 20-somethings, they were all, you know, around 20 years old, you know, 20, 25. These are kids. And that they couldn't fly a Cessna, but could fly a 757 like a fighter jet. And especially when I started talking about it to our pilots, and they're like, no way. No way. That's way beyond the aircraft's capability. And the thing would have ripped apart. Every once in a while I get an email from someone from Boeing. I heard your show on YouTube, and you're right. That airplane literally would have shredded. It would never have been made it into the Pentagon, flying that 270-degree corkscrew turn at faster than its capabilities at 35,000 feet. So, anyway, that's that. So
you remember back in the day when the 707 first came out. And that Johnson test pilot.
I hate to say this, but yes, I do.
And, you know, they were flying the thing over Lake Washington, which at the time was the, you know, home of where Boeing built all those planes. And that test pilot did a barrel roll in that thing. And he got reamed out from Monday all the way to the next Sunday for doing that. And the reason he did, I mean, he obviously knew that the plane could withstand. But Boeing basically said to him, you know, this plane possibly couldn't withstand that kind of a traumatic event of doing a barrel roll. Well, a barrel roll is nothing compared to what it is the story says that the 9/11 pilots did.
The pilots that couldn't fly. Yeah, it's just amazing. So I think as we're waking up and we start to see that we've been hoodwinked, as Max Eger says, we can start to see clearly, and I think what's happening is it's opening our vision for the future, and we can see that we're possibly going to get hit again by the same perpetrators that did this. It could be that they take out our grid in one area. It could be a chemical, biological, nuclear issue somewhere else. The whole country will be affected.
Well, whatever it is, it's going to be really inconvenient if it affects you. And that's why I think your message of preparation is so timely, because – you know, you can't, you just can't plan for everything, but you can prepare for most things.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And if you are prepared, you won't be afraid.
You won't be scared. Be prepared. Don't be scared. And like I said, when I look at people that are in a position where they can see that potentially the powers that be want to shut down Trump and or the election, and how will they do that? Now, I don't think they're stupid enough Well, Trump already knows to take that remote control off his plane and not let one go on there. But there's other ways they can take over an aircraft, too, by the way. Operation Home Run didn't use that. So there are things that they could do. But I don't think they would be that blatant to take him out unless they had an attack in a city that he happened to be in. But if they make the rest of the country so screwed up that we're all trying to survive, you know, maybe we don't have electricity, we don't have internet, we don't have phone, we don't know where our kids are, and we're all in a, you know, Chicken Little, the sky is falling mode, then they can tell us anything they want. And oh, by the way, the election's canceled. Remember, there was an election on 9/11. It was a either a primary, I think it was a primary that day, or a primary for their mayor or something. There was some kind of election, and they canceled that, obviously, because, you know, what was going on. And it's really fascinating to me when I go back with eyes to see now in this hindsight and look and read old newspaper things. And a lot of this stuff is still online, so you can go back and find archived newspaper articles from September 12th and 13th and 14th. And see who was saying what and how quickly they figured out who the terrorists were and you know, how quickly they figured out all of this information that, to me, struck me as being very suspicious. I was reading something the other day, just in my research. It was actually something out of the FOIA, and it was someone, it was Betty Ong, I believe, or Amy Sweeney, one of the flight attendants from Flight 11, and they actually, in the official document, said she, it was Amy Sweeney, she phoned her supervisor using her cell phone. Yeah, it was in the FOIA data, and I was like, oh, the official story here is that she used her cell phone. Aha! Well, you know, everybody still emails me and tells me, even yesterday, and I've got an iPhone, I couldn't make a cell phone call or text. There are only certain aircraft that are equipped with Wi-Fi and that you can do that with now. So you can get on that 4G network or whatever, some sort of satellite technology. It wasn't around for 9/11, but yeah, it's part of the official story. Actually, it was a file. I thought, I need to print this for the nonfiction, because I'm finding some stuff that is absolutely amazing. And I do want to take some time off from writing and putting everything together. I got to figure out the best way to do these screenshots of this stuff. A lot of it's in PDF. And so when you do a book, it's got to be in a Word document. So got to figure out how to put all that together and then explain to everybody what they're looking at, because that's the hard part, really, is there's stuff in Word documents written in plain English, just like this one. She called from her cell phone to her supervisor. I was like, all right, that's the official story. I think they changed that in the 9/11 commission hearing, but yeah, so she called from her cell phone. I'm like, okay, I wonder how she did that, because remember, she was on the phone for almost a half hour. That was a long cell phone call, and she actually made about 3 or 4 calls herself. She, you know, her call kept dropping. Yeah, I bet it did. But yeah, it's kind of amazing. And you know, I just have to look at this and I think, well, it's just like Lady Booth. Why didn't they say she was German? So we couldn't look her up. I guess she didn't have an accent, I guess. I mean, she would have to speak with a German accent. It would be really hard to give yourself a German accent. I don't know how you'd learn that. I don't think you could, actually. So it's like all this stuff is so blatant.
Let me just say, this is just a teaser, that in the new book that you parts and pieces that you have shared with me, there's going to be a revelation as to just how, in fact, Lady Booth might have come into existence. And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, that's a really great place to leave it. Yeah, it's I have to tell you, I am just mind blown at this stuff. When I get in and or someone emails me and tells me go down this rabbit hole, when I know where to look now in the FOIA documents and I know what happened and I know who's involved and I know how it got done, it's really easy to do a search for a word.
And you know who's lying.
Yes, I do. It's interesting, too, the people that have written books about their involvement, military people and politicians, that write their story. And let's just say they were on an airplane that day going somewhere that day. And they write their story. And then I've got their radar data because I even know the call signs for their planes that they were on.
Yeah, well, they wrote their books to cover their hotel pop-ups.
That's very true. And so, you know, I look at it and just thinking, wow, how do these people, how do they even look in the mirror? How do they even look in the mirror? Every day they get up, they shave, they brush their teeth, put their mascara on. I don't know how a human being could be a part of that plan and production that was 9/11 and still live, because some of them are still alive.
Well, it was compartmentalized. They just had a very small part that they had to do. They didn't blow up the buildings. You know, we managed to farm that out to, you know, a foreign government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't do this. They didn't do that. They just had little teeny pieces that they had to do that they felt were important for whatever agenda they were driving forward. And so they rationalize it and they learn to live with it. And that's how they do it.
Yeah, it's something I couldn't do. I know that. I mean, there just is no price tag for me. I can't imagine. Well, I guess they won't have to worry about sitting at the pearly gates talking about getting in, will they? I was going to say this.
Well,
like,
I wonder if TSA is at the pearly gates.
I think for these people, I'm actually might.
Oh, wouldn't that be great?
I might volunteer for that position. When I get there, I might just have to volunteer for that position. Because when they come, I know who they are. And they know I know who they are, which is just amazing to me that they haven't killed me yet. But I'm on the run. I keep keeping active, keeping on the move. And anyway, so it's just nuts what I'm finding. And I have to tell you, I'm just blown away. How evil can people be? But knowing how evil these people were, how evil they were to be a part of this, whether even if it was compartmentalized, they sure as hell can look back over the 15 years since and see how many millions of people we have destroyed their world. We destroyed their homes, their children, their kids, their mothers, their fathers, their farms. I mean, we have wiped out the Middle East. We're not done yet.
Well, we wiped out this country to a large degree in terms of people who served.
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. And, you know, you look at people that have gone over and fought these phony wars for their dope. And then you look into, you know, I remember in Methodical Illusion, I brought in the octopus. And somebody was asking me in an email the other day, how come I called it the octopus? That's what it's been called for a long time. Danny Casolaro, Gary Webb. These are people since the early and mid 80s that saw what was going on, that we know. Anybody that's been a private military contractor in Central America, you know what you were doing too. And a lot of them were murdered. Philip Marshall, the airline pilot, was a CIA pilot also, and he was involved with all of the arms and drugs in and out. This is the Mena, Arkansas. This is why Waco went down. There was an airport there that was running arms and drugs, and this is the Bush Crime Factory. So it's all connected to the octopus. It is a black operations, government gone wild, gone rogue, government agencies gone rogue, I guess you could say. And they have brought hell on earth, and they're not done. And I guess that's what, when you get in and you see this, I can't ever go back to believing the fantasy world that I used to believe, where the FAA and the military were going to save me and my passengers. I can't ever go there. It's gone, because it never existed. Now,
well, one thing you can be sure of, the TSA isn't going to save you.
No. The TSA is all, this is just a T, just setting us up. You know, you put the T, the little wooden T, and you put your golf ball on there, and whack. We're going to get whacked sometime, probably between now and November. So I think people just need to be aware and alert, awake. And anyway, listen, before I forget, I had written myself a sticky note here that said, you know, if you have not already done so, you can follow me on Facebook. I have a community page or a like page, and it's Rebecca Ross, author. And then my private one is the Stanford Tree logo. There's lots and lots of Rebecca Roths on Facebook, but that's my personal account. You will see the Stanford Tree.
If you want to get in touch with Rebecca, here is how you do it.
To contact Rebecca Roth, simply email your questions or comments to Rebecca Roth at RebeccaRoth.com. That's RebeccaRoth.com.
Ooh, I like that. Is that Brent Bozell?
It might have been.
I'm sure
he's not Navajo.
All right. Well, are we just about out of time here? I can't quite
I think we are.
Clock. All right.
About
well, thanks for joining us. And you listen, let those airlines know that you are not going to stand in line and you are not going to fly. Email, Facebook, let them have it, and drive. Go for it.